May it please the court, Christopher Yang, registration number 27770. I represent Mr. Albert Pacheco, the defendant appellant, who respectfully asks this court to reverse and vacate the convictions or for the alternative relief expressed in the opening brief's conclusion. This appeal presents four issues. Without intending to minimize the other issues, I intend to focus my comments today on the first issue regarding sufficiency of the evidence. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. In some respects, this case, a review of the transcripts indicates that this case is kind of convoluted and confusing, but ultimately, the appeal is not. The state did not prove the theft charge beyond a reasonable doubt because it did not present sufficient or competent evidence regarding the jewelry's value. This issue is controlled both factually and legally by two very recent cases decided by a division of this court in 2009, People versus Moore, People versus Jameson. These cases are discussed extensively in the opening brief, and I think it's somewhat telling, although not entirely surprising given this case's facts, that the answer brief does not spend very much time on either Moore or Jameson. In fact, it focuses more on the standard of review, even though, as I explained in the reply brief, the de novo standard of review in Colorado for sufficiency claims is clear. The spirit of Moore, the proverbial spirit of Moore and Jameson, controls this appeal's resolution. What those cases are saying is that good enough in the vernacular sense is not the same thing as sufficiency or sufficient in the legal sense. Those two cases recognize that an exacting standard applies given the liberty interest at stake. Additionally, the factual parallels, particularly between Moore in this case, are somewhat striking. The Moore court concluded there was insufficient evidence, relied on, the following was the key piece of reasoning in that case. The owners based the vast majority of their assessments on speculation, guesses, and assumptions, purchase prices many years old, and evidence, specifically an appraisal, that was not admitted at trial. That's precisely what happened here. Here, the state presented only the owner's testimony. And certainly, there's no dispute that an owner is permitted to testify and that an owner is competent under the right circumstances to testify about value. But the state did not present any expert testimony. It did not present the testimony of anyone else, for example, an investigator or a loss prevention officer, I believe is the term. It did not submit any receipts, any documents of any sort. And it's somewhat noteworthy that the state failed to do so, even though the owner testified that regarding some receipts, they were, quote, probably at home somewhere. And regarding the appraisal, quote, well, I haven't even looked for it. Those type of statements more or less enhanced the owner's credibility. Sort of, well, I guess if she had the receipts, then she must be accurate when she's talking about them. But the state didn't even bother to obtain them, much less admit them. And that really reveals the fundamental problem. The Moore court is very clear that an owner's perceptions, and that word is quoted from Moore, perceptions about and estimates of the jewelry's value do not constitute sufficient or competent evidence of its current market value. What Moore and Jameson are talking about and what the law requires is objective evidence. Certainly the owner can testify, but there must be objective evidence to establish current market value. When you look at the cases, as discussed in the opening brief, you can sort of find a dichotomy between the two sets of cases, sufficient evidence versus insufficient evidence. The case law sends a clear message to the prosecution. In addition to the owner's testimony, do more. Present some additional evidence. Present some additional testimony. Jensen, sufficient evidence. Investigator testified as well as the owner. Williams, sufficient evidence. Experts testified. Detective testified as well as the owner. Thornton, cited by the Attorney General and supplemental authority, sufficient evidence. Police officer testified as well as the owner.
Aaron, let me ask you this, and I think in this case, as I recall, the most or allegedly most significant valued evidence was a gold necklace that the victim had been given to her by her brother at some unspecified time. And she testified, as I recall, that she had it appraised at a store named Gordon's. I'm not sure what Gordon's is. I assume something in a mall. For $800, again, at some unspecified time. I understand your arguments that this is not sufficient evidence to prove the value. Does it prove anything? I mean, so it's not $800. Does it prove it's worth $10 or $20? What do we do with that testimony? Is it just like, it's like she said nothing about value?
Well, Your Honor, if evidence is insufficient as a matter of law, it's insufficient, as if it doesn't exist.
Well, let's say it's insufficient to do $800. Is it insufficient to prove that it had any value? Or, you know, if the threshold was $50, would that be enough to say it's worth $50? Or I'm struggling. Where do we draw the line here in these cases?
Well, I think you draw the line as I was saying, at insufficiency. If the evidence is insufficient, it's as if it doesn't exist. You know, the Attorney General is essentially asking this court to sort of do a post hoc mathematical analysis to somehow try and achieve the $1,000 threshold. And that's not what the law contemplates. The law says that the prosecution has to admit sufficient, competent, objective evidence of current market value. This necklace that you're referring to, notably, the Attorney General's answer brief indicates that the purchase price analysis, so to speak, applies equally to an appraisal. And I would agree with that. And by that purchase price analysis, what's being referred to is the notion that, you know, when you look at the date of purchase, and then you look at the time of theft, the cases say, you know, you can rely on purchase prices for determining current market value, but only if there's not attenuation, only if they're so close in time that you can reasonably assume or reasonably infer that the purchase prices are still valid as of the date of theft.
There's got to be some kind of sliding scale. She said, I purchased a $50,000 diamond ring 3 years ago. It might be a pretty long time, but and if the threshold is 1,000, wouldn't you be able to say, well, it must still be worth at least 1,000 if it was worth 50 3 years ago?
Well, Your Honor, obviously, I believe that with maybe some exceptions, everything is worth something. But I think that the problem that you're encountering is sort of the general problem here, which goes back to what I was saying about good enough, you know, in the vernacular sense, like, well, it's got to be worth something. Come on. I mean, can't we just assume now that it's worth something? Versus what legal sufficiency, what a sufficiency claim involves, and the exactitude of the requirements that are imposed on the prosecution in those cases, in these instances. If I might continue with the...
Mr. Gehring, let me ask a couple of things. Let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that there is insufficient evidence to prove felony theft. A misdemeanor would stand? Perhaps?
Your Honor, my position would be, and sort of in line addressing Judge Connolly's questions, my position would be that the evidence is insufficient in this case, period.
The burglary would still stand.
No, Your Honor, it would not, because the theft is the predicate conviction for the burglary. Without the theft conviction, there can be no burglary conviction.
Let me follow up on that. I know that you say that in your brief, but the burglary statute requires unlawfully intending a entry in a dwelling, and which I think is proven here, with intent to commit a crime therein. The intended crime here was theft. It doesn't have to be theft of any grade. It doesn't have to be successful. He could have walked in that door saying, I'm going to steal a valuable painting, could have been spotted, and could have run out the door, and that would still be burglary, wouldn't it?
Well, Your Honor, the intent, obviously, every crime has a mens rea, but I would suggest that without having proved the theft conviction beyond a reasonable doubt...
It's intent to commit a crime.
It's the intent, though. It's not the value of the items taken, it's the intent. And I don't think you're disputing the intent element.
Well,
you're disputing the value.
If in fact the theft conviction is invalid, that invalidates all of the elements regarding that crime.
How?
I'm talking about both crimes, because there is no proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime was committed.
Well, the jury found there was an intent under theft. you're not disputing that element.
I guess I'm not seeing the difference between, you know, when you if you're to convict someone of a crime, you've got to prove each and every element.
I'm referring to the burglary, though. I'm not referring to the theft, the value items taken in the theft.
I don't think that I have an answer different from the one I've given.
Okay.
Mr. Gearing, with regard to the theft, was there not sufficient evidence that there were items taken that were of some value?
Well, again, Your Honor, arguably everything that the owner testified about may or may not have some value. But without sufficient evidence to establish objectively that evidence's current market value, we're unable to make those determinations. We can't do that after the fact.
If the jury concludes that she was testifying truthfully about the items that she said were taken, could they not properly infer that those items together maybe had a minimal value, but they had some value greater than zero?
Well, Your Honor, there's a big difference between truthful testimony and sufficient testimony, legally sufficient testimony. I'm not here today to call Ms. Quintana.
No, but what I'm saying is, if they concluded that, yes, all of these things were taken, could they not infer that they had at least $5 of value?
Well, again, that goes back to the hardest problem, which is that you can't make those type of inferences based on insufficient evidence.
So the inference is not permissible.
Right. For example, in People versus Paris, there was testimony about, okay, the following items were allegedly taken, and in roughly year X, they were purchased for a certain amount. The court concluded that there was a three-year gap between that time and the time of the theft. And the court concluded that three-year gap, only 3 years, was too attenuated. So in that situation, there was not even an evidentiary basis or an evidentiary foundation to really, to conduct the type of analysis. Excuse me, I misspoke. In that situation, there was an evidentiary basis to conduct that analysis. We could look at purchase prices in, say, 1975, and we could look at 1978. In this case, we don't know when a single item was purchased or gifted. We have no idea when the appraisal occurred. What we know is that the items were allegedly taken in 2008. So we do not have an evidentiary basis that would allow anyone, including the jury, including us now looking at it after the fact, to make these types of inferences. That's really the problem here.
But I have 2 minutes. And just quickly, I'm just stuck on the no value argument. If you stole my pen, I don't know how much it was bought for or how old it is, but if you took that, couldn't you be convicted of Class 2 misdemeanor theft?
I suspect, Your Honor, that you could, with minimal effort, either through, I'm sorry, not you, well, you yourself, through minimal effort, or perhaps...
It's a state pen, but it's a state pen.
The prosecution, prosecuting me for stealing it, with very minimal effort, could send out an investigator and find objective evidence of that pen's current market value. And then, yes, I would be convicted. I would like to reserve the rest of my time, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Sagai.
Good afternoon. My name is John Seidel, bar number 17633. To begin with, I'm going to try to answer some of the court's questions to Mr. Gearing. I agree with the court, at least the suggestion, that the burglary is not going to be affected because the jury only needs to find proof of an intent to commit theft. And as the court recognized, the jury found that intent existed, and they could rationally do so based on simply the conclusion that some items were taken. So the burglary is going to stand. In fact, the prosecution wouldn't have even needed to charge theft. So the guilty verdict on the theft is not really relevant to whether the burglary would stand. Now, it's telling, I think, what Mr. Gearing said at the very beginning, and he alluded to it again later on, he said the prosecution didn't produce sufficient or competent evidence. And that was the heart of what I'm trying to get at today. In People v. Moore, and many cases prior to that, it's well established that an owner is always competent to testify about value. Now, recent cases like Moore have said, well, we're not going to accept that where the item isn't so new that it hasn't depreciated so much to preclude a reasonable inference as to value. Now, as I said in my answer brief, the problem with that is it assumes that newness is the only thing that guarantees or is an indicator of what an item's current value is. Well, you know, that may be true for some items, toasters, what have you, but it may not be true of jewelry. I think that, and now the reply brief says we don't have any evidence of gold's value. Well, that's true. On the other hand, juries can use their common sense and ordinary experience to conclude or draw inferences from the evidence presented. And in this case, I don't believe that the jury would be wrong or could make a rational conclusion that these items were valued at what the victim said they were. Now, I want to go on beyond that, though. Even if the victim or the prosecution had provided receipts and brought in the appraisal, the proof that he wants would still not be satisfied.
Let's talk about what they did bring in. They didn't bring in the appraisal, and they have a testimony that she got as a gift from her brother, date unknown. She got it appraised at some time, date unknown. We don't know the weight of the gold. We don't know the carat quality of the gold. We know nothing about this necklace other than it appears that it was a gift that was personalized to her, that it had her name on it and a couple of beads unique to her. I mean, we're taking a pretty big leap here. Isn't it the kind of leap that Moore and Jameson did not take? It seems the prosecution could and should have done better. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that this is not the best proved case. Neither was Moore and neither was Jameson. And I believe that Moore and Jameson were responses to, I would call, spectacular or gross failures of proof. But I don't believe that this case rises to that level. But beyond that, and I think that we could sit here and talk about the factual distinctions between this case and those cases. For example, in Moore, you had people, victims, getting up there and guessing and admitting they're guessing, estimating. I really don't know what the value is, but I'm just guessing. Okay, that's not this victim. This victim says these things were, hope I didn't mess up the electronics. Pardon me. These things were worth, the eight watches were worth $50 a piece. The necklace was appraised at $800. My ring, I paid $125 for it.
How about Moore? Moore seems like a better case. You had a victim saying half carat diamond earring studs purchased several years earlier for $1,500. And the court there said that's not good enough to prove anything. It could be argued that's stronger than the testimony here.
You know, and that's, you have a good point, Judge, and that brings me to my primary point. Nobody, well, almost nobody, gets a current market price for all the stuff that they have. Your pen, my laptop that's 3 years old, my piano, you know, my kids' stuff. Nobody gets that stuff. Nobody gets it appraised. Nobody knows what the market value is. Insurance papers don't do any good because they have their own calculations. He wouldn't accept that, my guess is. In fact, there's a good quote in Burns versus People, and I don't know if it's cited in the brief, but I'm only basically quoting it. It says, you know, unless you're in the business of selling the goods that are stolen, you don't know what they're worth. And now, of course, once the theft has happened, the goods are gone. Most people don't have pictures. They can only remember slightly, you know, vaguely what the things are worth or what they look like and what condition they're in. Now, if value depends on what two people contracting would reach on a price right now, where does that evidence exist? Okay, is it in Craigslist or the classifieds, or do you have to bring in a pawn shop person?
Well, Mr. Seidel, I appreciate your argument. I mean, in the sense I understand your logic. We have six jurors there. they each are going to have to come up with some conclusion as to value. I mean, some of these people have not a clue, wouldn't they? I mean, what's our basis for saying this jury can reasonably make this inference based on their experience? They may own no gold. They may have never have tried to sell an old bracelet. They may never have gone to a flea market.
Well, if I understand the court's question,
you have to give them something.
Well, okay, but the victim is up there testifying, and she says this is what they're worth. Now, why can't the jury evaluate her credibility as the same as they would any other witness?
They need to know upon what basis she is making that judgment. I suppose if she had gone on the internet, on eBay, and done something like
that.
Why
would they have to accept? Well, and I don't mean to question you, but
no. But I guess what I'm saying is, if she comes in and says, I don't know, $400. How can the jury even evaluate that credibility without knowing when was it purchased, what was its condition, where are you coming up with $400, or are you speculating? Are you just guessing?
Well,
don't we have to give the jury something?
I agree that if somebody said, I'm just guessing, that would be a problem, but this victim did not. Now, the question is, are you assuming that someone who comes in and says these things were worth $50 a piece? Are you assuming that she's just speculating? Or are you going to require, or is the jury allowed to say, well, I believe her, that sounds reasonable?
Or is it the prosecution's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she has a good faith basis for her estimate?
Well, that's not what the statute says. Okay, the statute says anything of value, and then the value has to be above a certain threshold, and it doesn't say the prosecution has to prove that the person has, and this gets to my point, the what they're advocating seems to be, it's not good enough anymore to be a victim. You are not competent to testify about the value unless you bring in an expert or you can show me pictures of what the item was in its exact condition and show me when you bought it, and bring in some more evidence about what the current market value would be. And if it's jewelry, you're tough luck, because there's probably no similar item out there for sale. My point is, if we have come this far, we have now contradicted the principle that victims are competent. We are now saying, no, you are not competent.
Well, but our law is not that victims are competent per se. I mean, our law puts certain parameters around that, doesn't it? I mean, aren't there certain parameters around what is sufficient testimony from a victim?
Well, you know, I would say that you have the recent cases like Moore and Jameson, and you have old cases, which one of them, which is, for example, People versus Evans, which is a case that Moore tried to distinguish. My reading of that case is the victim got up and said, I had a watch that I think was valued at $80. That was good enough. Way back in this court decided in 1990. Now, the Moore division tried to distinguish it by saying, well, she said something about she bought it at less than market value, but that doesn't tell me anything. The fact is that she valued it at $80, and that was good enough. There are cases other than Evans which are similar. If you go back to People versus Austin, 529, 3P2nd 989, the victim said, I would accept $400 for these tools or for this car if I had it and I had to sell it today, and that was good enough. Rodriguez versus People, 450P2nd 645, Supreme Court case from 1969. Victim's valuation of the tools was upheld, even though he didn't know what the current market value was. And then there's the Burns case. And if it's not cited, it's 365P2nd 698, a Supreme Court case from 61. Now, of course, these are old cases, and the cases that they're relying on are new. But it seems to me like you have the pendulum is swinging from the old to the new, or you just have a conflict of authority. I think that Moore and Jameson were examples where the prosecution really didn't do anything. Moore's closer. I don't think it was rightly decided, but This case is not that case. And if we are going to say that in this case the evidence is insufficient, you are really saying you've got to have an expert. And suppose the victim in this case had gone out and done internet research. She comes in and she says, well, I looked on the internet. His argument's going to be, well, who cares what you did? We don't know what you, how true you are about that or how truthful. We have no way of verifying it. It's almost like you got to have somebody in the courtroom and doing the internet search during the trial.
How about if you just brought the appraisal in or had the appraisal come in and said, this is what we did. We know nothing about the appraisal here. We don't know when it was done. We don't know how it was done. We don't know if it was valued. We'll give you store credit for $800 if you do that. We know nothing about the appraisal. Do we?
I would say that suppose she had brought the appraisal in. I think the exact same argument, at least some of the same arguments, would be made that, well, gee, how do we know that's not just store value? How do we know that the guy that the victim actually had to sell the thing, it would only fetch half the amount that it's appraised for?
You could rely on the Thornton case that you've cited supplemental authority and say, and you'd have a response. I think Thornton is a different case, the case you relied on, and it might be a better case had you had an appraisal actually brought in here, wouldn't it?
I'm not saying that the prosecution shouldn't have brought or that it wouldn't. I think that would be a better case, but what I'm trying to get to
why would it be better?
Why do we really need that in every case for every item?
Why would it be better then?
I don't think it would be. Okay, I guess I misspoke. I think that a jury could look at an appraisal and say, well, gee, that's efficient. You know, I guess that's good. But he could make the same arguments. Well, the victim here isn't testifying that appraisal wasn't done for some specific purpose and has overvalued it. There's no foundation for the, and so we need to bring in the appraiser. And then we get to cross-examine the appraiser on his purpose in doing it.
Let me ask.
The theft becomes a giant battle of the experts.
Let me ask you this, because Mr. Gehring's arguing that, you know, if we were to conclude that the evidence is not sufficient to show any particular value, then it's not sufficient to show any value. His argument is that if we find the evidence not sufficient to show the value alleged here, we have to reverse the whole conviction. What's your position on that?
I disagree. I think in Jamison was the most recent case where a division of this court said, well, if, even though you don't get past the threshold, we still can find that the items had some value between zero and I think the current threshold is 1,000. And so to say that they had no value is to say nothing was taken or the things that were taken were valueless, they were garbage. Okay, that to me says the victim's testimony was incredible as a matter of law. And to me that's different than saying her testimony is insufficient. So I think that at the very worst, you would have to drop down to the next level of theft, which I think is M2. But I'm urging the court to look at some of these older cases, and some of them may not be. In fact, I think some of them are not cited. If necessary, he can respond in writing if you think it's necessary. But I just think that in cases like this, unless you're going to turn the whole thing into a battle of experts and requiring everybody to go out and do internet research, and even then that's not going to be good.
Let me just toss out one final thought and you can respond to it in your time left, which is not a lot. This is a pretty consequential fact. You're taking a crime from a misdemeanor to a felony based on a $1,000 threshold. Isn't that a key element that has to be proven? It's pretty consequential to a defendant. You're either a misdemeanor or you're a felon.
I agree, but when the amount of the theft is just like any other element. It's because it's necessary to the punishment. Apprendi and that line of cases says it's got to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And so the standard of proof is the same whether you're going from, say, F4 to F2 or F3 felony theft as it is going from misdemeanor to felony. Thank you, and I appreciate your time.
Mr. Seidel, you've mentioned the cases Evans, Austin, Rodriguez, Burns. Of those, are any of those cited in your briefs?
I thought maybe Burns was, and I think Evans is discussed in the brief, and the other two Austin and Rodriguez are not.
Austin and Rodriguez are not, for sure, and...
Evans is, and Burns, I think, is too, but I could be wrong about that.
Hey, why don't you check while Mr. Gehring finishes his argument? Bailiff, why don't you give Mr. Gehring 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. Very quickly.
Excuse me. Just give him a total of 2 minutes. Can you do that? So there you go. 220 works. Perfect.
Thank you, Your Honor. With all due respect to Mr. Seidel, he's incorrect about Jameson in terms of the court finding that the evidence must have had some value. In Jameson, the reason the court was able to find the lower grade of crime was because because they were self-authenticating. There were a few items that were taken. This is in a footnote 5 or 6 of my opening brief. The items were stocks, were cash, were bonds. They were self-authenticating. Thus, there was an evidentiary basis to establish the lower grade of theft. It was not a question of the court sort of saying, well, the items must have had some evidentiary value or some value. Second, I don't think it can be reasonably disputed that value is an element of theft. I mean, that's clear from the cases. Third, I'm not suggesting that victims are incompetent as a matter of law to testify as to value. Not the case at all. What I'm suggesting is, that the testimony in this case was insufficient. Certainly, I can envision a number of situations where the prosecution does nothing but call the victim, and they're still able to meet their burden. Obviously, if they can introduce documents and have other people testify, that would help, and in some cases, that might be necessary. That's not what happened here. So I'm not suggesting that this is going to create a situation where victims are incompetent as a matter of law and the world, the sky is going to fall. Second, the notion that the jury could just sort of infer, make these inferences and that kind of thing, basically the same thing that the state is asking this court to do now, that would work if there were an evidentiary basis for it. And that's the distinction I explained earlier between Paris and this case with the attenuation. The quote from what the Jameson court found was, the Jameson court found that because the evidence was insufficient, i.e. because there was no evidentiary basis, the Jameson court explicitly rejected the state's argument that, quote, common experiences and knowledge, and then this is not part of the exact quote, but can be relied upon, back to the exact quote, to reasonably infer the item's current market value.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Mr. Seidel, are those other cases in your brief?
No, in Evans, I thought was
But Burns is?
Burns is not either.
Okay, so we have 4 cases. Evans, we actually have 5. You have 4. Evans, Austin, Rodriguez, and Burns. Mr. Gehring, do you want an opportunity to look at those and submit something with regard to them?
Well, want's an interesting word, Your Honor, but yes, I feel compelled to do that. I'd also, in conjunction, I don't know if the court would, I've written like a post-argument letter. Is that what
that would be sufficient to the judges on this division? You can get the case citations from Mr. Seidel.
May I also, Your Honor, as part of that letter, may I also address 2 other issues? One being the Thornton case that I just received on Friday from Mr. Seidel that I didn't really have an opportunity to talk about today. And 2, I would like to address the questions that came up about the intent to commit a felony. Given that the issue was raised more or less sua sponte by the court today, it had not been raised by Mr. Seidel in the brief, it had not been raised in my briefs. May I include in the letter those 2 issues as well?
You can comment on the Thornton case.
Okay.
All right, and can you have that to us not later than Friday?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. This case is now submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.